Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
This is Recode Media with Peter Kafka. That is me coming to you from my house in Brooklyn. It's still a pandemic. I hope you're well. I hope you're safe. Delighted that I get to not meet, but talk to Sam Hargrave, who has directed, can we call it the biggest original movie ever on Netflix? Is that official yet, Sam?
I believe it is. That came out from Netflix, so you can say that.
The movie is Extraction. It is an incredibly violent and very enjoyable action movie starring Chris Hemsworth, who many of you know as Thor. It is also Sam Hargrave's first ever movie. So you make your first ever movie with a giant action star. It's on Netflix, and it instantly becomes Netflix's biggest movie ever. How's that feel?
I've got to be honest, Pete. It's a really surreal feeling to successfully make a film is an achievement. I mean, because I've worked for many years in this business and been on a lot of movies, and you know, just finishing them, getting it done is an achievement. But to then be in the director's chair and to direct something that where you get a response as positive as it has been from people around the world, and then to be, you know, the biggest Netflix feature film, you know, release ever it's unbelievable. I'm still pinching myself.
So the numbers are, I think they're saying 90 million people have watched this worldwide in the first 4 weeks of release.
Yeah, those are the numbers I read. It's insane. It's really, really something.
And for context, Spencer, I think, Confidential, I think it was called, a Mark Wahlberg movie, came out early this year, was the number two. That was 85 million. And again, for context, lots of people I know are talking about Tiger King. I think that did 64 million. So this is a giant, whopping hit by any standard. And as Sam was mentioning, he has a really interesting backstory. He was a stuntman for a very long time. You have probably seen him in a movie because he often doubled Chris Evans, right? Do I have the right Chris?
Yep, this is right. There's a bunch of Chris's in the Marvel universe.
Yeah, well, I was confused. I was going to get it wrong. But see, you're Captain America.
Yes, sir. I was for many years. It started with the first Avengers film that we did shot in 2011. Came out in 2012, and I was in the suit. I was the captain when he's falling down or fighting or getting beat up. That was my job.
You get beat up for a living, and now you get to get other people beat up.
Right. Now I get to tell other people to get beat up for a living. It seems like a fair exchange.
I want to talk about your path because it's a really interesting one, but I want to focus a little bit on the Netflix of it right now. The people who listen to this podcast tend to be interested in sort of the business of tech and media and where they intersect. And the idea that Netflix, after spending years trying to figure out how to make movies and how to get people to watch their movies without a lot of success, something seems to have clicked, and they seem to consistently be making movies that a lot of people at a minimum are watching, is really interesting. Can you tell me the story of how this movie became a Netflix movie? Was it always going to be a Netflix movie?
This film has had a very interesting road, kind of a long road. Joe Russo wrote a script or a version of it maybe 8 or 10 years ago. It was called Ciudad, took place in South America, and it went kind of through the studios, and you know, they wrote a graphic novel based on this story, same story. But then recently Joe, you know, got the rights back to the option back for the script, and then changed it to take place in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and in throughout India, just because it was he felt like the South American action movie setting had been played out a lot in Sicario and Narcos, and it was kind of saturated in the marketplace. So we wanted to give audiences a new location that they hadn't really, Western audiences.
Should we explain who Joe Russo is? I think half of our audience will know.
Yeah, Joe Russo is the, you know, half of the directing team of the Russo brothers. Joe and Anthony Russo were the directors at Marvel. They made a little movie you might have heard of called Avengers Endgame, where it's kind of the most successful movie of all time. They also did in Avengers Infinity War, Captain America Civil War, Captain America The Winter Soldier. And I actually, interestingly, did all of those movies with them.
So you're doing stunts with them for the movies they're making.
Yeah, I started out on the Winter Soldier as a stunt double for Captain America, kind of reprising my role in the Marvel Universe as a double for Chris Evans. And it was on that film that we met. And then the next time I would work with them, they would offer me a stunt coordinating job. So I designed the action for Captain America Civil War. And then it was Avengers Infinity War where the, you know, topic of directing came up. And that's where, you know, these different stories intersect for the movie, you know, that was Ciudad that became Extraction, that script came across my desk from Joe. He said, hey, you know, I think this might be a really good first movie for you. And I read the script and, you know, I agreed in that it had amazing action description. Joe's a really fun writer. Like he really keeps it moving and very detailed in his action description. But it also had a heart at its center that really I think is important in any movie, but especially action movies in this genre, to have a reason to cheer on our hero and to kind of sit through all of these crazy violence that we see. You have to have a reason. And I think when I read it, Extraction, it had that.
So while Joe Russo is making incredibly complex, incredibly successful movies for Disney Marvel, he's writing another script. He's been working on it for a long time. Was the thought then, we're going to make this for Netflix from the get-go, or was it, this should be a Disney movie? Or maybe it's not a Disney movie because it doesn't involve a franchise. How did it end up coming to my screen?
Well, it definitely was never intended to be a Disney movie. The level of violence was always too high.
It was always going to be a really...
It was
gruesome, and I don't mean gruesome pejoratively. Like, we're going to show you someone getting their eyes poked out with a rake.
Yes, it was always a very real, very gritty, very hard R script. You know, it's kind of in the vein of a lot of those like action movies from the 70s and 80s where they weren't, you know, shying away from it. They were leaning into that genre. So it was always meant to be that. But, you know, it bounced around. Once he asked me to direct and I said yes, and then we got Chris Hemsworth attached. So when you have that package deal, it's a very, you know, attractive to different studios. And it went around and around, but it ended up at Netflix because Netflix provides a great home for many filmmakers. But for an action movie like this, in the theatrical kind of or the studio system, you know, they're going for either the big budget blockbuster superhero movies or kind of the lower budget, you know, movies, something mid-range action doesn't really have a home, or if it does, they're few and far between at the studio level.
What's a mid-range action movie budget these days?
Budget-wise, I mean, I would consider it between 50 and 100 million.
So a lot of money, but not a $300 million.
Right, a lot of money, just not, you know, half a billion dollars to make a movie like, you know, like the two Avengers movies combined. Like, it, you know, just a huge investments for them. So mid-range is, I guess, the term I would use for something between, you know, 50 to 100 million. And that, it's hard for, and I get it, that's a tough, especially an original IP, an original intellectual property that isn't proven, you know, it's you're taking a risk. And so it's now with Netflix and other streaming platforms, these kind of movies find a home. And so as soon as Netflix kind of saw this movie and who was attached, they made an offer. And, you know, it seemed like the right fit for this movie and for all of us to go over there and get on the streaming platform.
So when this becomes a Netflix movie and it's a done deal and the contracts are done, does that change what you were making? Do you tweak it in some way to either because you know it's going to end up on a lot of small screens, because you know it's going to be distributed around the world? Is there anything you do or don't do once it's a Netflix movie instead of a Paramount release?
No, in a way, it actually provides you more freedom because Netflix, it's global. Like, there's hundreds of millions of subscribers all over the world, and viewers, you know, they're not restricted by language or location. Like, they're going to get it to all of their viewers however that needs to happen. And so, in a way, it's an advantage for more people to see your movie. And I think we saw that with this, with the, you know, the numbers of this release. But we being the filmmakers like Joe Russo and you know, Hemsworth and I, and along with our DP Tom Siegel and everyone involved, we saw it as a cinematic story. And so we chose the 2:40 format because we all are lovers of cinema. Like, we didn't, you know, sometimes, and we went through this discussion.
The aspect ratio, right?
Like, yeah, the aspect ratio that we would, in the widescreen format, you know, there's different aspect ratios that change the way you view the film. That's a very cinematic, you know, aspect ratio. And we were all fans of cinema. So rather than changing it, which sometimes filmmakers do to be more easily viewed on the phone or to fit the, you know, the computer screen that might be 16:9 aspect ratio, whatever, we decided to stick to the format that we all loved consuming our, you know, films in. And we shot it basically for the big screen. Like, we wanted to have, you know, nice epic vistas and, you know, get in there and make the action feel big. We didn't change our filmmaking style based on the format that was going to be streaming.
And was the idea that it's set in a foreign country that people can't find on a map, or I'm assuming most people can't find on a map, is that a matter of that's the best place to tell the story, that's a cheaper place to make a movie that looks like that, this is international, we figure there's a significant audience that will want to see this part of the world represented? How does that come about?
Yeah, you touched on two of the reasons I believe we did. Is one, for the story, it was a unique setting for a story like this to take place because, as you said, most people can't really find that on a map. That would mean they're not, you know, inundated or saturated with that part of the world. Be like, oh, another movie, you know, in Dhaka. Like, that doesn't, you don't hear that, you know, phrase. Mm-hmm. So it's a unique already. And you take a movie that in this genre, like, you know, it's like kind of a redemption story that, you know, it's been told before. We're putting our unique spin on it by taking this story and setting it in a unique place.
Grizzled guy, done a lot of bad things, has maybe one last mission, and it looks like a suicide mission.
Right. You know, that conceit has been seen before, but you take mm-hmm. that story and put it in a different location, and now it has, you know, a fresh twist. And so that was one reason. The other was that you said it was globally, like internationally, there are a lot of people in that part of the world who, you know, with a story like this taking place there, could, you know, identify with and kind of get behind and be supportive of and want to see their, you know, that part of the world represented in a Western film.
So, I mean, I will say that after seeing that Spencer Confidential had done really well, and that, like, again, like, at least in my version of social media and my version of buzz, almost no discussion of it. Then when I saw you were next up with Extraction and that it starred another big action hero that people would know and then was set in Dhaka or just set somewhere else, I thought, oh, I think this movie is going to do really well. I think the Netflix guys have kind of figured out this formula at this point. You take a recognizable American action hero, you put them somewhere, and people are going to want to watch it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Netflix is hitting their stride, I think, in as far as, you know, not that they haven't, but they're really, you know, I think playing with the big boys, as you could say, as far as the studio movies, like, they're making big action movies with big stars, big directors. Like, they're, you know, a big time studio. And I think the response that we got from this film is indicative of the, you know, the influence they have around the world and how many people are, you know, kind of tapped into this Netflix machine, which is delivering, you know, content to people globally. And what's crazy is, you know, everyone can watch it immediately. Like, as soon as you put it up there, everyone gets to consume it.
So what does that feel like? They release it, I guess, on a Friday, right?
Right.
What does it look like to you? I think we're obviously in quarantine then. Traditionally, right, you'd have projections for the first weekend gross, and then you'd be looking at the numbers all weekend and seeing how you did. What does it look like when you're the filmmaker and you want to get a sense of how well your Netflix movie is performing that weekend?
Well, Netflix does a very good job of communicating with the filmmakers. They're just, I mean, very hands-on and involved with the process, and they want you to, you know, be as well and just know what's happening. So they do, it's like, you know, 3 days, 7 days, 10 days, and then I think it's 28 days where
they're giving you numbers.
Yeah, they sit down with the filmmakers and they say, hey, these are what the numbers are looking like. These are kind of the projected numbers. And this is just keeping us informed, as you know, kind of as you will with a studio system. They, once they get the numbers, they would share them with you. But Netflix is very, you know, they're very involved and very open and with the filmmakers, at least. And it's been a really cool process. I mean, we have yet to hit the 28-day mark. So we'll have another meeting and see what those numbers are. And, you know, they're just keeping you informed as a filmmaker.
And does that, I mean, I guess it's sort of hard to imagine what 90 million people or whatever the 3-day number is or the 7-day number is sort of in an abstract way. Can you feel it sort of on the internet or maybe your phone's blowing up? I mean, is there a way that sort of popularity registers with you?
Well, I think, you know, when you've made it, when somebody, you know, makes a copycat trailer, or they start making memes of the movie. And I saw one the other day where these two kids, it looked like somewhere in Africa, they had recreated the trailer for Extraction in just, you know, in their backyard. And it was amazing. But you do, I mean, for me, what's interesting with that number is I think there was 90 million households.
Right.
And so if you think like how many people in a household, that number could double or triple or quadruple. So that's a lot of people all across the globe seeing this film, which is exciting. And when it's kind of the talk of the town, so to speak, but globally, you're getting a lot of emails of people that you've, or, you know, phone calls from people you haven't talked to in a long time, just because all of a sudden, you know, everyone's watching Netflix. And if you've lost touch with people, it pops up in the Netflix feed. It's like, oh, like I used to know that guy. Or you see it on Instagram, everyone's posting about it, but not just your friends and family. It's people, random people in very far reaching corners of the world are, you know, touched by this and have experienced this film. It's really surreal. Like I said before, it's hard to fathom.
So like you said, this is your first movie. You're 37, is that right?
Yes, sir, 37.
But you've been on a lot of sets. You've been around a lot of movies, a lot of big budget movies. How do you think you, first-time director, making a serious movie, a significant movie for Netflix, how does that experience change if you are working at a conventional studio? Or at this point, is it kind of the same thing?
Well, I mean, I've worked on a lot of big films at the studio level, but not in this capacity. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think, one, my experience at Netflix was incredible. Like, I would work with them again in a heartbeat. I had a great time. I think we made a good movie, and they were very supportive all throughout the process. You know, I think the difference, or it would just, I think now moving forward, it's really in this time that we're all going through. You mentioned quarantine. Everyone's kind of looking to see how are we as a film industry going to adapt and react? So I mean, the future in that way is very interesting to kind of meditate on. And so I don't know what the future holds, or working with, you know, studios versus streaming, like how that's all going to break down. But at this moment, you know, I have had meetings with many different people at many different studios and streaming platforms just to meet people, to be out there, and to see what is the next best fit. Because every time you have to sit with your team and kind of look within and see what's best for the project, the best avenue for the story, and the best challenge for you as a director. What's the best next best move? And, you know, when the time comes, when things open back up, we'll be ready to make that decision.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, right, there's a whole slew of big budget movies that were supposed to come out this spring, this summer, maybe this fall, and those many of their release dates have been pushed back because mm-hmm. we don't know if we're going into movie theaters. And this is the kind of movie that would have been in a theater, right, in an earlier version. But as you said, like, it works perfectly fine on your phone. I think I watched half of it on my phone. That doesn't offend you, right?
No, I mean, it can't. Like, we were very aware of everyone's going to have a different viewing experience of this. And that's actually kind of an amazing thing, is you can touch, reach out to and provide an experience where, you know, maybe you don't have the time because you're whatever your life circumstance, but you can have your phone with you at all times. And maybe you're, you know, just sitting alone and about to go to bed, and like, I don't want to get up and go to the TV, but I want to see this movie. I just pop it up on my phone and enjoy it. So it's
you
really
have described
kind of awesome.
my cinematic experience for quite some time now. That's exactly what's happening. I have other questions for you. I want to take a quick break so we can hear from sponsors. We'll be right back.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
This week on The Gray Area, writer Derek Thompson makes his case that everything has become a cult. Well, almost everything.
Is Taylor Swift the closest thing we have to a mass cult today?
No, I think she's the closest thing we have to Christianity. It's
me. Find out if you're in a cult this week on The Gray Area, wherever you get your podcasts.
Still here with Sam Hargrave. You are aware you're out in California. How's your quarantine?
Yes, sir. Out here in California, quarantine, you know, it's really, I think it's kind of similar for a lot of people. Everyone obviously has different circumstances that they find themselves in, but we're all in this together, and I'm just trying to control what I can, which is my attitude and perspective. So I try to stay positive and just do things, you know, that'll hopefully improve my craft and improve me as a person. I'm trying to stay healthy and working out and meditating and, you know, playing music, but also trying to write and, you know, read a lot of scripts and just be prepared for, you know, the next step of my career should all of this stuff, you know, pass and we get back into the movie making business.
I'm assuming you want to make another movie. I'm assuming people want you to make another movie. Have you done real thinking about how your movies are going to get made in this new world we're in, where maybe there's not going to be a vaccine for an extended period of time, that there won't be a sort of normal for a long time? Have you thought through like how you're going to work with hundreds of people and live action and all of that, or maybe it just can't happen?
I have. I mean, it's definitely something that goes through my mind, is that, you know, what is going to be normal? How are we going to, you know, create these worlds where, if, for example, if you have to, everyone has to stay 6 feet apart? I don't know. Is it possible? I don't know. Does every action scene become, you know, a shootout with guns or bows and arrows? Like, will we ever be able to return to, you know, intimate scenes, whether it be lovemaking or fighting with someone? It feels very intimate. Those are all questions that kind of churn through my mind. I don't have answers.
And these are small cities, right? When you put on a production like this, how many folks are working on a set of a movie your size at any given time?
At any given time, ballpark. On our movie, there were days where we fed, you know, 600 crew members. But the core crew, I think we had between 150 and 300 individuals on our movie. And at times, you know, that would balloon if we had a large set piece with a lot of security or background. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in general.
And then you think through like all the people have to support that group and the catering and transportation. It's a lot.
It's vast amounts of people, you know, involved in this and working together very closely for long periods of time. So the logistics of that, you know, I don't pretend to understand or have an answer for, but I am very interested to see what the new normal or what the next steps look like and how that's going to impact the process of making films.
I have other logistical movie making questions for you, if you'll indulge me. So again, your background is stunts, and we'll talk more about that. This is a movie that I'm assuming is Extraction is a movie that appears to have been all live action. I mean, obviously you're using digital stuff here and there, but I'm assuming that most of the cases when I see Chris Hemsworth kicking someone or getting kicked, that is him kicking someone or getting kicked, or his double. It's not CGI'd in the way that, you know, lots of other movies are. One, why make a movie that way instead of relying more and more on digital?
For me, I've always been drawn to movies that were made that way, where you see a real person engaged in real action, and there, you know, there's real danger, there's real consequences. I grew up loving and watching Jackie Chan movies, and I don't think there's anyone who is more real and putting themselves, you know, their safety on the line, risking their life and limb for the entertainment of audiences around the world.
Do you think the audience picks up on that they get the difference between Chris Hemsworth in your movie and Chris Hemsworth in an Avengers movie, that there's more risk for him?
I do think that's palpable. I think you can, I mean, as great as CGI is these days, as advanced as it is, I still think there is a tangible difference when you see a human doing something for real. I think there's a difference, and people can, I think a lot of it has to do, or can be seen in the response to movies like the John Wick, you know, to Extraction. Like, what, you know, why are people responding so much to these movies?
John Wick is also made by a former stunt double, right?
Exactly. Former stuntman, stunt coordinator, fight coordinator, second unit director, and really close friend of mine, Chaz Stahelski. Like, I think that was one of the, you know, I'll say first, but in recent history to really demonstrate the power of physical action with the actors really performing it, and, you know, not relying on CG for a lot of these, you know, spectacular stunts. And we try, you know, followed suit. We because we both, Chad and I and Dave and other filmmakers, kind of come from that school of inspiration from the Hong Kong filmmakers, among many others. Like, it wasn't just we're trying to copy these guys in Hong Kong. That was one of the inspirations. But I mean, what they did and how they did it was super influential in our filmmaking growth. And so to pay homage to that and to kind of return to that, it's kind of, I think filmmaking is kind of, it comes and goes in cycles. And so now, you know, it's kind of a return in a way to that real gritty filmmaking where you see people doing the stunts. And the beauty of that now with advances in technology and safety is you can make those stunts that are still real. You can improve the safety measurements, like, because it's easier to paint on a wire to, you know, so when someone's jumping across a balcony or jumping over, you know, something where in case they fall, you can save them, or you can put a pad down and paint it out in post, or, you know, help in certain ways to increase the longevity of the performer or to make them safer.
They're still doing the stunt. It's just easier for them to do the stunt or less dangerous.
I wouldn't say it necessarily makes it easier. You still got to, you know, still got to make the jump, still got to fall. But it does, you know, in a way, eliminate some of the variables that could lead to injury. So that's something I love about the advancement of technology, is it helps those realistic stunts become safer so you can do more of them.
And if we just break it down into dollars and are just really crude about it, dollars and time, and is it easier to do the live action stuff because it's X number of people in this amount of space and you know what's happening and you don't have to worry about animation later? Or is it, you probably can't do an apples to apples, right? A fight in Extraction versus a fight in an Avengers movie. But which one takes more time to accomplish?
It really depends on the scenario and you know, who's involved in the. There's so many variables in that question. I think what we're getting at, and what I can attest to, is having designed for both, is as a director, as a you know, someone making the film, I like to be able to see, you know, in camera what we're going for. Like if we've got, you know, a guy fighting six people, say we're in the, you know, Extraction, and we all of those guys are there and we're interacting with them in real time. And on the Avengers movies, sometimes it's just Chris swinging his hammer in front of a blue screen at people who we will add later who aren't even there. So it's just a very different approach. Now, easier, you know, that just depends. If you're in the stunt department, it is easier because it's, you know, it's just one guy swinging a hammer. Now, for the
less likely to get hurt.
Exactly. And for the visual effects department, you know, it's you know, a lot more work. So, and then dollars and cents, it depends again on, you know, how much and how big, but it's starting to become, you know, a little bit more even and almost leaning in towards the, you know, in this example of guys, you know, fighting and digital guys, almost easier because so many movies have been made now with those digital assets. So when you go to those companies, they already have those and they're not, you know, they just reuse what they have. So it's actually, in a way, becoming cheaper to do certain CGI sequences and then more expensive to do it in camera. So you know, I hope that that doesn't start to outweigh the, you know, or sway the decision so it, you know, more and more and more becomes CGI as the technology becomes better and more realistic and less expensive, because I think people need that human element in movies, at least to balance the other. Because there's a place for, I love the Avengers films. I love the fantasy genre. Like, the you can do things now and go places and tell stories you never could many years ago. But I think there needs to be a balance on the other side of that to kind of you know, satiate the need of reality or of a bit of a it's a little more of a realistic dream, or a more relatable to a guy who, you know, isn't flying around with a hammer and you know, can is untouchable.
And also just novel, right? You just haven't seen it in a while. And you and I grew up on some of these movies, but a lot of people have never seen movies like this. John Wick is kind of the first movie they saw like that. One last movie making question. You have at least, I think, two, I don't know what you call them. Do you call it a one-er? It's the idea is it's supposed to be one long tracking shot, sort of unbroken shot.
In the business, the lingo, one-er is what we've termed it. I think you can call it a lot of different things, but for the sake of this, we'll call it a one-er.
And the most famous one of these, I think, is still Martin Scorsese in Goodfellas, where they're walking into the club. And you see them occasionally, and it seems like we're seeing more of them recently. Mm-hmm. The one I remember everyone getting excited about was in True Detective, that season with Matthew McConaughey. And obviously 1917 is supposed to be one long version of that. Are you making that because you think the audience gets what you're doing in response to it, or is it, I want to try it because it's a really hard thing to do and I want to see if I can pull it off because Martin Scorsese did it?
and very well, we might add. I mean, there's been, you know, we weren't the first to do a one-er, and, you know, I wouldn't even argue that we're the best. That we just, and I've done them before. Like, I did, you know, in Atomic Blonde, I designed and shot that one-er in the stairwell sequence with Charlize Theron.
Oh, that's another brutal fight scene.
Yeah, so for me, and I learned that through from Dave and the other, my experience with one-ers, that the reasoning has to be rooted in storytelling, and it can't just be, or it's better if it isn't just based on, hey, let's try this thing because it's cool. And so the thought process in Extraction was to do this extended take in order to provide a kind of a different experience for the audience. So, you know, not many people have probably, I mean, some people maybe listening have, but to extracted someone, you know, violently out of a foreign country, you know, so to put the audience in,
I'm
that
guessing it's a small slice of our audience.
Right. But so for those who haven't, to have that experience where the camera kind of becomes a voyeuristic point of view of the, you know, of the audience member who gets to go along on this journey and see this happen in real time, is, you know, something that I thought would be important to this story, just to, so you feel the pain, you feel the surprise and the emotion and the excitement of this sequence, and then hopefully that feeling invests you even more into the emotional development of the characters, and then it carries, you know, so that by the end of the movie you're more invested. That was the idea, was to use that as a storytelling technique. And then hopefully along the way, it's exciting and people that technically can go, oh, that was very difficult and they did a good job. But ultimately, it's based on storytelling.
Right. And if you're in the audience, you shouldn't really be thinking about your technical difficulty in making that, right? Because it
takes you out of that. If you do that, then you just haven't, you know, you haven't succeeded in the, you know, in the task, which is getting people immersed in the story and following you on a journey with these characters.
The other thing I think about, which is not a novel idea, is that I play video games, my kids play video games, and a lot of that stuff reminds me of sort of that over-the-shoulder perspective you have when you're playing like a first-person shooter, or I guess not over-the-shoulder. And that's sometimes, it almost fits more with what sort of an audience expects from action. And maybe I'm making too much of a leap, but it does seem like there's a connection to video games. It doesn't seem forced, it just seems organic. Like, this is what you're doing on your own, and now this is in a movie.
Yeah, which is kind of ironic in that I think the last video game I ever played was GoldenEye.
I remember that one.
And before that, it was Duck Hunt. So I'm not a real big video game person. I'm very aware of that culture and the, you know, influence and the significance of that way of, you know, digesting entertainment. Like, it's huge. I mean, the gaming business is actually bigger than the filmmaking business as far as dollars and cents go.
Indeed. I kept talking about your background. I do want to ask you about it before we go. You've been in movies for a long time. you're not an old person. Was the plan always, I want to move my way up the stunt ranks and eventually make a giant action movie starring an action hero? Or was this sort of happenstance?
No, that was always the goal. Now, a big action movie, I'm just very fortunate that that's how it turned out. I always wanted to make, you know, movies, direct movies. That was something that I, you know, came to Los Angeles with the intention of doing. Now, I was inspired by Jackie Chan in all aspects. His career path was extremely inspirational to me because he went from a stuntman, a martial artist, a stuntman, actor, you know, producer, writer, director, editor. He did all of it. And so for me, that was the goal, was to do all of these jobs. And I loved martial arts. I loved performing. You know, I enjoy acting. But the kind of the place where you get to have more creative control and to have a bigger say in the storytelling is in the director's chair.
So that was always the plan. I want to be an actor and I'll be a stunt double first, or I want to do something else. And I wanted to go that route, but it was closed, so I did stunts.
No, like it was, I mean, it wasn't, you know, I want to be a director, but I guess I'll just do stunts while I'm waiting. Stunts was I'm very passionate about and something I wanted to pursue, but knowing that the body can only take so much punishment and that when I do something, I do it 110%. So, you know, when it came to stunts, I went for it. But all the while, you know, I never kind of wanted to pigeonhole myself as to doing one thing. Just like while doing stunts and acting and directing short films on the side, I was playing music and, you know, to developing other skills, because I think life is meant to be lived in its fullest. So I don't want to, as much as I can be focused on, you know, making a movie or being a stuntman, I try also to expand that to other aspects of life and enjoyment. So I'm not trying to limit myself to just being at the time, the best stuntman or, you know, the best actor. I wanted to do it all. And I guess maybe it's greedy, but I see it as kind of just trying to live my life to the fullest and realize all the different potentials that I might have and just test myself in different ways. And stunts was the first part of that. And then along the way, there were other acting, you know, endeavors. And then it was, you know, fight choreography and that leading to stunt coordinating, all the while developing the filmmaking skills. And you know, I would, even while just doubling and being on set of The Winter Soldier, I was always, rather than finishing my stunt and be like, great, I did a good job, let's go back and, you know, focus on the stunt side, I would go and stand behind the monitors and watch the Russos and see what were they doing, how were they preparing the next shot, what was their methodology.
And so you're very much, I want to learn, and also you're signaling to them, hey, by the way, I'm taking this seriously, and so it's not an accident that they show you a script at some point.
Right. I mean, and it's funny because that wasn't, you know, I'm not purposefully going like, oh, in like 3 years, I can see these guys, or 5 years, giving me a script. I was trying to be fully invested in the moment. And I see that these guys have a lot of filmmaking knowledge and they're very open and willing to talk about things. And so I would ask questions. I'd be present, you know, with the filmmakers to try to learn as much as I could. And then through that process, with the responsibilities that they would hand off in the stunt world, you know, hey, we'd shoot these things called, you know, fight vises or pre-visualizations for action, where we take what's on the page and we choreograph the action and then shoot it with video cameras and then edit it together and present to the director.
Sort of the next level up from storyboarding. Like, this is what it'll like when these guys actually punch each other.
Exactly. It is. It's a kind of a living, breathing storyboard process. And I've done that for many talented directors through the years, including Chad, Dave Leach, you know, Francis Lawrence, the Russo brothers. Like, I've had a very varied career in that aspect because I've worked on a lot of different films for a lot of different filmmakers. But every time doing that process, I was directing a sequence.
Right. So you're making a little movie within a movie.
Exactly. And I wasn't just doing it to like, oh, well, you know, let's just do this and get it done. I was fully invested. How can I make this the best mini movie possible? And then I would show it to them. And then the great thing, it was I'd get feedback because it was related to the movie they were trying to make. It was part of this bigger process. They'd be like, ah, you know what would be better here, I think, is this close-up or, you know, a shot of this telling this story in a better way. And I would take that. I'd write it down. I would just absorb these notes. And so all those lessons and all that practice of directing these sequences, I think, you know, it was gathering experience for when I got the opportunity to do something like Extraction.
And you get hurt less. What you mentioned, sort of the lifespan of a stuntman. How long What's a reasonable amount of time you can do this kind of physical work? At what point do you have to sort of tap out?
You know, it really depends. I mean, I think the career spans are getting longer because of the advances in technology and safety. But I also, my first job in Los Angeles, I worked for a stunt coordinator who was on our set, still crashed a car, flipped over a car at 72 years old.
Yeah.
So, like, it really depends on the individual and the, you know, the circumstances and how well you take care of yourself, what stunts you do. Like, it's very different. But I would say for me, you know, I didn't want to beat my body up for the rest of my career or to have to. You know, I still enjoy performing, and hopefully I can perform and choose to do or not do stunts later into my career.
Were you kicking and punching on Extraction, or are you on camera there?
You know, you might recognize me. I did come in for a little cameo there and play, gave myself a few lines, and that was actually Joe Russo's idea.
And you've got a giant beard, right? So I can see if I can go back and look for you.
Okay, it's the beard. Great. Look for the beard.
Look for the guy in the beard. And you're in one piece. What's the worst injury you've endured as a stunt guy?
Worst injury. Well, I've been very fortunate throughout my career to not sustain, you know, any kind of one major injury. I think the worst would be the number of concussions that I've sustained over the years. I'm up in the double digits. So it was kind of one of the factors there later on, just to be like, hey, I need to kind of slow this down a bit. Because, you know, I always was looking for the big stunt because I was inspired by Jackie Chan and his stunt performers in his movies, and I just wanted to do that. It was the thrill and the kind of the pride of having done something like that and survived. So I was put, and then even coordinating, I put myself in the big spot. So that adds up, and so I think that would be probably the worst thing that had been.
Yeah, don't concuss yourself anymore. I will not leave this podcast on a dumb pun about knocking yourself out. But I am delighted that I got to talk to you. It's very fun. I look forward to meeting you in real life one day. Thank you, Sam.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for your time.
That was super fun. Thanks again to Sam. Thanks again to Jelani and Joel, who produce and edit the show. Thanks again to our sponsors, who let us bring the show to you for free. A bunch of more cool stuff is coming your way for free in the near future. Thanks for listening. Thanks for writing. Talk to you soon.